My name is Mel Basil. I'm born into both Gixan and Wet'suwet'en. So I am both Gixan and Wet'suwet'en. That's a very, very interesting concept because I'm also part Scots-Irish. And in my ancestry, I also have African-Canadian and Chinese in my ancestry. So I come from Four Corners. What I'm most pleased about coming here is we come to a place that's viewed as a centralized power, Victoria. And I'm very pleased to meet with the anarchist community, even if you're non-anarchist, but you're interested in anarchy. I myself consider myself an anarchist, but I'm also an indigenous sovereigntist. I've never looked at myself as an activist, but we have taken action. I've never experienced Canadianhood. I've never found myself to be a Canadian person, nor a British Columbian. I am indigenous, I am Gixan, I am Wet'suwet'en. Along with being Gixan and Wet'suwet'en comes a lot of responsibilities of being Gixan and Wet'suwet'en. Being from a state, you're expected to abide by laws and rules and constrictions. Being part of an indigenous society, a traditional society, where really all of you can admit and feel like you've been a part of a historical indigenous background. All peoples in the whole world were indigenous at one point. All peoples come from an indigenous origin, a beautiful origin, an origin where human beings were closely related to the world around them. And colonization has impacted each and every one of us to some degree or another. And violations against our peoples, our indigenous origins, are run deep. For many of you, you may feel that colonization has impacted you much longer ago. For us, it's maybe a couple hundred years. A couple hundred years, colonization has impacted our peoples. And yes, it has been very deep because it came along with genocide, it came along with ecocide. And what you're probably here for as well is you're probably here to learn a lot about some of our struggles and how it relates to ecocide and genocide. And I have to tell you, our perspective is quite different from some activist communities where we're not just focused on the ecocide and the genocide, we're also focused on the hope and the strengths of our people and of our allies. And we saw great hope at our recent camp in August, August 6th to the 10th, at the Unist'ot'en camp in our territories, at a river where you can drink straight from, no treatment. And with really good people with a lot of hope in their hearts, they came hopeful, and I feel that everybody left hopeful. And here, back home, still hopeful. So what I'm experiencing now is I've come to an urban center, and it's a shock every time I come to an urban center, because we're in the back country so much. I have the farmer tan to prove it. What we have been doing in the last 15 years is really preparing our minds, preparing our skills, preparing ourselves to deliver something unique and beautiful, which is decolonization. And what I've shared with many of the anarchist community who have come to our camp is that, and I want to share with all of you, is that my viewpoint of anarchy and anarchist communities is that you've stepped away from that colonial construct, and you deny colonial construct. And you don't believe that anybody is more qualified than you to live your own lives. And you might have questions about how that might blend with creating an alliance with indigenous societies, traditional societies. And I could give you a few of those my viewpoints. I don't feel that you need to take those as solid information. I don't have it in writing. It's in my heart. It's just some observations, and it can bring some great success in how our anarchist communities and indigenous societies can learn to relate to each other. because for those of us who are grassroots indigenous societies, we have begun a decolonization process a while back. For me, it was before kindergarten. When you first enter a school, you're expected to pledge allegiance to a flag. Back in my generation, we were expected to stand up for a flag and cover our heart and pledge allegiance. And I refused to stand up in preschool and in kindergarten. And the teachers were stumped, and I wound up being shifted to another class because that teacher did not like that I wouldn't stand up. I wound up sitting in another classroom. And even that teacher had a struggle with the concept of somebody refusing to stand up for the flag. And I was sent to the principal's office. And my mother was telephoned. And for some reason, maybe even social services might have been phoned. Why is this child refusing to stand up for this flag that everybody else is standing up for? And in kindergarten, I was asked by the principal, you know, why didn't you stand up for the Pledge of Allegiance? Everybody was doing it. I said, I'm not everybody, and that flag is not mine. And he just respected that and just sent me back in class. So, yeah. So good stuff. I didn't know until I was a preteen when we were studying ideologies. I'm a world historian. I love world history. I love the history of human beings. And also thinking about everybody's stand with biology and traditional knowledge, because we were being shown traditional knowledge by our elders, by our families, how to cut fish, how to prepare it, how to preserve foods, how to walk on the earth so that you don't disrespect the earth, how to walk with people in community gatherings, how to teach, how to learn. We were taught all of those things. And what I didn't know is that the elders were also teasing me a lot. And I thought that was mean at first, but then I learned later that they're helping me deprogram myself, because we learned a lot of BS in schools. And so you get that deprogrammed out of you as you go along, and that's the connection we have with our families, is you always have the strong, powerful elder in those circles that can help you deprogram yourself while you're going along. And it's with that teasing, that what feels like it's mean, you know, like they're poking you with a cane or something. And it wasn't. What I learned later was that they were doing me a really big favor in helping me shed what wasn't needed. But they showed me how to figure out for myself what that was going to be, what I was going to shed. So what I intimated with all the anarchists that came to our community and to our camp was, you've taken that step of decolonization, denying colonial state, and looking at your own lives, how you want to live your life. So who's going to show you how to live in the territories when that time comes? Survivalists might have a clue, but it's not a complete connection to the land. The government never will be able to tell you how to live your life on the lands. But they have maps and they have schools, and there's some ways of learning within the government system, the education system, but as we mentioned earlier, it comes with a lot of BS. The elders in our territories, in our communities, have shown us for thousands and thousands of years how to live on our territories so we do not decimate the territory, we do not overfish, we do not overhunt. And we made mistakes within those thousands of years. That's why we have trickster legends. We have trickster legends telling us what mistakes our ancestors made, which transformed the world around us. So in a trickster legend, it looks like it's a few days' time when the world transformed because of their mistakes. But really what happened was natural laws took place. And when our ancestors broke natural laws, they had consequences. And they weren't quick consequences like today, like right this minute. They were consequences over thousands of years. Mm-hmm. So trickster legends developed over thousands of years of observation of our interaction with the natural world around us. So you might ask yourself, what is natural laws? And it's not the same thing as what Galileo and Einstein might talk about with physics and natural laws. That's a different kind of natural laws, you know, about inertia and gravity, and that kind of thing. I'm not talking about those natural laws. Natural laws is where did the lynx get their long hairs? Where did the lynx get their long hairs on their ears? What purpose do they serve? Why do we eat the cambium layer of the pine tree during a certain year, certain time of the year? And why do we eat only that? Natural laws, they exist with or without humanity. They've existed on this planet before we were created. I have to also admit I'm a creationist, and some of you might not follow the same path, but as a creationist, I understand what was given to us as people. We were given natural laws to learn from. And even if you don't believe, those natural laws do exist. And when you break natural laws, there's a consequence. We're learning that with the tar sands. We're learning that with pipelines and tankers. You mess with natural law, you get consequences. You get shortened supply of food, shortened amount of time that you can harvest foods. And natural laws is basically something that the world around you tells you that you do certain things a certain way and the world will give back to you. So one of the most important natural laws I've learned from trickster legends and from people that showed us how to do this was take what you need and leave the rest. Unfortunately, capitalism and corporatism and democracy don't understand that concept. Capitalism says, I want it all and I want it now. But natural law says, take what you need, leave the rest. Now, how indigenous peoples related that with our own indigenous laws was through... So we took what we needed and we leave the rest. My wife isn't here, but I'll say I can hunt on my wife's territory. I have a responsibility to feed my family while we are on her territory. If we were not married, I could not hunt on her territory. I could not even step foot on it. So we have clans. Our clans help us govern our own laws. It helps us self-regulate our laws. There's no police or social workers or hierarchical structure telling us that we have to live our laws a certain way and we're breaking the law, so we have to go to this building with restrictions and for a time. There was nothing like that. There was no punitive adversarial system to guide us. We had elders showing us the way. And how they showed us was, in stories, was I could hunt on my wife's territory, but I could not overhunt. I could not profit from being on her territory. So for a day's worth of resources, I could fill a bentwood box. Do you know what a bentwood box is? A bentwood box is a plank of cedar folded into four, into a sealable box that you could seal food inside it. If you dry it properly, it could last for years and years in a cache. So a bentwood box was genius technology. You didn't fall a tree down. Based on natural laws, you didn't take the tree's life to build a bentwood box. You took about a plank's worth out of that tree, left it standing, and built your bentwood box out of a piece of wood that was still alive. And it had life and spirit. And you stored your food in this with the trust that you're connected to your land, regardless of where you bring this box. And you would probably carve your clan's crest on the sides and your story so people would know and recognize where that came from if you happened to trade it for something else. Now, I could fill one of these per day on my wife's territory. That is how we regulate and self-regulate our law of take what you need and leave the rest. So with this backward system that exists today within capitalism and corporatism and industry, they ask permission at the Ministry of Environment to access lands that aren't theirs, to extract resources in the millions of bentwood boxes per day without our permission. And yes, without equity, without cost benefits, all those terminologies that mean nothing to me, really. It means something to band offices. It means something to treaty organizations, and it means something to tribal councils for some reason. They pay attention to those kinds of terminologies because they are the arm of that central power from Ottawa and Victoria that says this is how you're going to operate as treaty organizations. You're going to operate as tribal councils or as band offices. Basically a boardroom table. You're going to make decisions from a boardroom table for all of your people, even if they're not at that table. And they're going to issue these terms that are not based on natural law. They're based on construct law. So decolonization and how this relates to anarchy and what I just spoke of with natural laws, does that kind of give you a clear picture of what natural laws kind of does? Natural, yes?
It might also be that it's not about like God-given right to the queen, but mostly responsibility as a man.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we're not talking about rights here. Central powers and construct governments, they give you rights. They're a hierarchical system telling you this is what we're going to give you and exchange for what? Exchange for your mental slavery, for for your controls, for your health. In terms of what we're experiencing with rights, people that have no cause to tell us that they're giving us rights, telling us that they're going to allow us to live a certain way on our own lands. If you've heard of the terms fourth world, when you're looking at the hierarchical structures of superpowers, you have the first world, second world, third world, fourth world. Fourth world is not in education systems. It's limited. It says there's first, second, and third worlds. There's developed countries, developing countries, and undeveloped countries. And that's talking about states within international law, within another construct law based on more racist terminologies. International law comes from racist background. Have you heard of the Papal Bulls? Doctrines of Discovery, they're given different names. Well, it's basically a document written on parchment paper, probably hemp, marijuana paper. God love it. It's Papal Bulls were written on a paper. It was a writing system by popes. So popes from the Roman Catholic Church wrote for their monarchs how they're going to be allowed to colonize lands and colonize peoples from indigenous peoples. And because we're subhuman, we were considered subhuman in these documents. So basically, if you're not part of the monarchy systems, you were subhuman. And Papal Bulls wrote how you could colonize these lands if you were a colonizer, an invader. So along with that came the basis of the language for international law adopted by the League of Nations. The League of Nations later on became the United Nations. And the United Nations, 500 years later, writes the rights of indigenous peoples. So the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is from a hierarchical structure, telling indigenous peoples how we're allowed to live on our own lands. Based on international law, based on papal bulls written by popes. So what we got going on here is this racist document that's very similar to that of a document that said that a white man could own a black man as a slave. So what you got going on is the very same kind of document, very same racism, telling a nation state like Canada, like the U.S., that you can own lands that aren't yours. So the colonial states, they didn't have any knowledge of the backcountry, the intimate knowledge that our people had. Another form of natural law and how we self-regulate is... sorry, I'm jumping all over the place here, but I need to revisit this one topic. Because I'm still comparing natural law and construct law here. So what we got going on is salmon. Our people are finishing up and wrapping up our harvest of salmon. And in the past, we had an intimacy with the salmon world that we could recognize a family of salmon that were going to go up a certain stream. And we did not overfish that stream. And we even had runners to tell other communities further up. We've caught our quota how much we usually catch from that one stream. And we also made sure that we didn't devastate the habitats of those streams. Intimate knowledge of your territories. Our chiefs could even feel on the back of their hand if somebody was crossing their territory without permission. Mm-hmm. If you had a trespasser on your land, the chief of that territory was married to that territory. They had such an intimacy with the land and with the biodiversity that we're all a part of, that they could even feel a trespasser hunting on their territory without permission. Mm-hmm. Makes your skin crawl, right?
Yeah.
I've heard of people saying that they actually still have that sense of their lands. Mm-hmm. And indigenous knowledge is both born into us, but it's also shown. And natural law is the whole background of the whole thing. Natural law exists whether we believe in creationism or not. Natural law exists whether we are part of a colonial construct or an anarchist community or an indigenous society. So all I'm pointing out to you is there is natural law ongoing outside of the urban centers. We access those areas for foods, for biodiversity. Farmlands within urban centers cannot exist without the health of the biodiversity outside of the urban centers. Pollination is required clear across the board. Pollinators need to be healthy. Our people knew these things. So the take what you need and leave what you leave, take what you need and leave the rest. That self-regulation of our law was really, really important to us. To me, it's still the most important. What we're doing today is, I mentioned earlier, is that all peoples were colonized. What that means is our minds, our bodies, our spirits, and our emotions were all impacted by a point in time where we were colonized as a people. Statism became the norm all over the world. And whether you're from an indigenous background, or people of color, we're all people of color. We're all people of color, right? I want to just assert that too. And that means we're all indigenous. But I have to remember that at some point, colonization removed us from our origin, our point of origin, our place that we call home. And state powers said that they have control over your lands, where you are connected to the earth. You have intimate knowledge in your histories of the world around you. 200 years ago, our people were removed from those very effectively with violence, genocide, disease, ecocide, and state control. Violent state control. There was gunships pointed at our villages at some point. Gunships pointed cannons at our villages if we did not agree to let DFO assert their sovereignty in the waters. That kind of thing happened. Villages were threatened here too. Not just Papua New Guinea today. Villages in our territories here were also threatened. Genocide has taken control over many, many nations that have become extinct or close to extinction. And lands have been taken over with violent control. So all over the world this has been happening. And if this happened in European countries maybe a couple thousand years back, and people have learned to mix over time, really, really transformed who you are and have become a little less indigenous, a little less connected to your traditional lands, compared to our people, we're still in our lands. And we're still being shown by our elders how to interact with our territories, how to have a relationship with the water, how to have a relationship with the world around us. We're still being shown. It's not in completion. We don't have a complete set of laws right at our doorstep anymore. We're still figuring that out. And as history keepers, storytellers, drummers and singers, as leaders, we are bringing that back. And for us, that is decolonization. Decolonization for us has been knowing the land, knowing your territory, we're reawakening that sense of, holy smokes, you know, somebody's on our land. Let's go look. Sure enough, there's somebody out there. When we thought this through, how we were going to present this to the anarchist communities coming to us to our camp in August, and sorry I didn't properly tell you where Wet'suwet'en is. Have you heard of the Skeena River north of here? We are a tributary to the Skeena River. We're inland. We're not on the coast. We're inland about 4 hours, 5 hours drive from Prince Rupert. But we're inland. We're nearby Smithers. So the Wet'suwet'en extends from Hazelton's to past Burns Lake. Smithers is within that. Houston's within that. Houston is a very, very industrialized little town. Smithers is getting there. Smithers is touting themselves as this little tiny town that is becoming very big, and they are. Mining is really big in our territories. They have a school of mining in the college in our local area. A lot of our people are interested in mining. Now, is that a bad thing? It can be if it's open pit. It can be if it's a pace and scale that our people and our biodiversity cannot coexist with. Pace and scale is really, really, like you say, capitalism says, I want it all, I want it now. So pace and scale of mines do impact water if they want it all and want it now. Civilization keeps wanting to expand. The economy is being forced to expand. And traditional territories and indigenous peoples who are still connected to them still hunt, still fish, still access the vegetation on the lands, and still drink the water, are being impacted with their health.